Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So summit day, and we're halfway along now. Yeah, it's a pretty cool place. We're looking straight at a kind of an eruption of rock and ice straight in front of us, in the middle of a sea of snow and ice. In the distance, just clouds. So we're above the cloud line. So it's a pretty cool scene. So yeah, so far so good.
Mount Vincent, the Antarctic, one of the highest and most remote mountains in the world. An Irishman, Paul Devaney, has the summit in his sights.
It's 6:30 on the 5th of January 2014 and we are on top of Antarctica. Thank God for that. Yeah, nothing but peaks pointing out through snow. It is amazing. It's been a long old push up here. But definitely worth it up here. Definitely worth it.
Now, this might sound like the end of a journey, but really, it's the beginning of another one. Because for the last 7 years, Paul Devaney has been climbing the highest mountains in the world as part of the Seven Summits Challenge. From Africa to Australia, Europe to the Americas, it's been an epic journey across all seven of the world's continents. And it's one that's almost coming to a close. In fact, there's only one mountain left, the most legendary of them all, Mount Everest.
This is adventure, you know. This is what a variant of this is what, you know, the guys had to deal with on a larger scale 100 years ago with endurance. You know, ordinary people doing extraordinary things. That's kind of what I see this as. I've kind of got some of that ahead of me. I've finished now my sixth summit of seven, and Everest is the only one left. Who knew that day would come? But here it is, and we have to be ready mentally. We have to be agile to deal with changing surroundings, changing topography with avalanches, nice falls, and changing circumstances. And you gotta want it. You gotta want it enough that when you go for it, you get it.
Less than 300 climbers around the world have managed to climb all seven of the summits involved in the challenge. And Paul Devaney, originally from Clough in County Longford, hopes to be one of them. Paul's own story of climbing mountains began back in 2005, when he was working for Rolls-Royce in Hong Kong. Before leaving the country, he decided to make the legendary trek to Base Camp, a seven-day trek through mountains and valleys that brings you right up to the foot of Mount Everest.
It looks black, and you can find it because it's black. You know, there's a white mountain, there's a black Mount Everest. And then you can see this beautiful cloud formation just over it, and curling back up on itself. It looks so beautiful and peaceful and picturesque, but if you're up close to it, it would be like a very, very high-speed train just constantly whizzing past the mountain.
The winds on Everest can reach up to 200 miles per hour as the jet stream slams into the side of the mountain. But every year, for a few weeks in May, these winds die down enough to allow climbers to try for the summit. Paul has been dreaming about this for a long time, but the funny thing is that when he started off, he didn't actually have the greatest head for heights.
In terms of tolerance of height, he's pretty much down at the bottom rung of the ladder in the house.
So he's scared of heights?
He's terrified of them.
That's Colm, one of Paul's brothers who was responsible for updating the social media while Paul was climbing the highest mountains in the world.
We were astonished by his interest and then his progression in mountaineering. Because there was no history of it.
By 2012, Paul had climbed 5 of the highest peaks in the world. But to train for the final 2, he left his well-paid job in Berlin to return to Ireland and train full-time.
He certainly has suffered for his art, there's no question about it. And from what you hear of his training regime in Limerick, you know, it's quite intense.
Come on, this is fast enough.
The University of Limerick boasts one of the most modern and best-equipped sports facilities in Ireland. And it was here where Paul spent 9 months preparing to climb for both Antarctica and Everest. Paul's training focused on everything from strength training to yoga, but he also focused on endurance training with instructor Aidan O'Keefe.
Like, for people just think it's just a mountain, there's more than a mountain. Like, when you look at base camp is basically the same height as Kilimanjaro. So you're over 5,000 up already, and then you're going, oh Lord, he still has to climb a mountain.
Aidan, tell us a little bit about what was actually involved in Paul's training for Everest, and I suppose for Antarctica too.
We had a plan of climbing the stairs of a building down the road further, just constantly up, back down, just to build his legs, just get used to that endurance, getting used to the weight of the boots. Steppers inside, Stairmaster. There's an arc trainer inside, long hauls on that, just pure endurance, just pure hard slog.
To prepare his body for breathing at high altitudes, Paul also lived and trained at one of the only facilities of its kind in Ireland and the UK, the National Altitude Centre at UL. By controlling the amounts of oxygen being pumped into each room, the house can simulate heights of over 4,000 metres. Now, this helps prepare climbers for breathing the thin air of Everest.
Again, during your training, how are you feeling?
Grand, yeah.
This is Rachel Turner, who's working with Paul on altitude training. Rachel has been to Everest Base Camp before to study the impact of altitude on climbers, and she knows firsthand the dangers of climbing at the same height as a cruising jet aircraft.
What's difficult about Everest is that you're so far and above the level which people can actually aid you down. Even trying to lead someone down who's very ataxic or uncoordinated makes it very difficult to rescue people, even if you recognise the symptoms and you want to bring them down. It's an incredibly dangerous place.
As a testament to the dangers of Everest, there are scores of frozen bodies scattered along that final push for the summit. In fact, even stopping to try and help someone in trouble can be incredibly risky.
That was one thing that scared me with Paul, because I know he has a heart. And if anyone got in trouble on that mountain, he would sacrifice himself, sacrifice his dream, just to help that person. Like, a prime example was on Antarctica. He went out and a person got in trouble with their own sled, dragging it along, and they just weren't able for it. But Paul loaded their stuff on top of his own and doubled up the weight in his own sled and dragged that for him so their dream could come true. And like, that's the true character of the man.
What did you think, Eileen, when Paul said that he was going to be climbing all these mountains now over the last few years?
I didn't realise what he was going to. You know, it didn't seem to be enormous at the time, but now I know.
Paul comes from a family of 9, and they've supported him from the very start. But with a few weeks to go before he's due to leave, his mum Eileen is worried.
But the possibility of an avalanche or...
Not as much as...
Ice slide or anything like that.
Very little. They used to be in the early days when the Sherpas didn't understand the mountains so well. Mm. They used to put camps in fairly ridiculous places, but that's not become as big an issue at all.
As Paul reassures his mum, nobody could have realised just how deadly avalanches would prove to be for Everest 2014. Paul has put a lot on the line to try and realise his dream, spending over 100,000 euros of his own money on the Seven Summits Challenge, with over 30,000 on Everest alone. And all of this just to have a shot at climbing the tallest mountain in the world.
Why do I want to climb Everest? I guess I want to create a bit of wonder in my life, if I'm being really honest. It's not that I don't have wonder in my life, but I think when I go to these extraordinary places and have, you know, the privilege to do these extraordinary things, it motivates me to do things that are harder but better than the alternative. And that's a pretty darn nice way to live life.
So
88.6.
Okay, and sleep, how many hours?
Back in UL, and Paul is having one final checkup with Rachel before getting ready to leave.
I mean, the cough is still there, and it's still, it's not gone away yet, but it doesn't harm the train at all that much, so.
I think it's important that you just keep that.
A few weeks earlier, Paul caught a cold, and while it's nothing to worry about at sea level, the higher up you go, the more serious it becomes.
It's very common for people to get upper respiratory tract infection when they're climbing. The air is much drier, obviously it's a lot colder, and there's a lot of dirt and dust particles, especially on the trek up to Everest Base Camp. So it's common, it's actually called the Khumbu cough, and it's definitely something that we would have discussed in terms of how you would avoid it, but also how you're going to treat it if it does happen to you.
Paul ends up taking some medication before leaving for Everest, and the cold seems to have disappeared by the time he arrives at Dublin Airport to meet up with his friend Niall O'Byrnes, the other half of the Seven Summits Challenge. From there, the pair leave for Kathmandu and meet up with one of the most important members of their team, their Sherpa, a guide called Mingma, who has been up and down Everest 19 times.
We'd met Mingma at the airport when we arrived. He had a huge welcome for us. You're typically, when you meet Nepalese folks, they'll present you with a scarf of some sort. So you're constantly accumulating religious scarves. And we met him at the airport and he presented us with our scarves, and we presented him with some Irish Seven Summits hoodies that we got for him and his son. And, you know, we'd been talking to Mingma a lot before the expedition, but this was the first time we met him. He's a very warm chap. And there was a very immediate rapport, I think, between all of us and Mingma.
When you arrive at Hillary and Norgay Airport at Lukla, just 24 miles from Everest, you're surrounded by huge mountains and no real roads. Paul has brought with him over 50 kilos in climbing gear, and the only way to get it to base camp is by Nepalese yak.
Yeah, they're extraordinary creatures because they're able to deal incredibly well with low air, thin air, low oxygen environments, which is why they're used, why they thrive up there. And so they have bells attached to them, partly so you can hear them coming and partly so their owners can find them. But you'll always hear this kind of ding, 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 ding the whole way up the valley until you get to Everest Base Camp.
Paul also brought with him a small audio recorder to capture the sounds of his journey to base camp along the way.
It's the 3rd of April. We're on day 7 since we left Dublin. We're in Namche Bazaar at 3,400 metres. So today has been our rest day, acclimatisation day. We trekked a fairly steep bit for about an hour and a little bit, up to an area where you can get your first glimpse of the mountain. So we're able to stare out at Everest in the distance and Lhotse beside it, and it's a very nice place, beautiful view. Just looking out the window, and yeah, it's a completely different scene. It's a winter scene out there, and you can feel it. Temperature's cold. Saoirse Rowntree is up ahead of us, Irish girl who's trekking to base camp, and she's up at base camp, and she said it's minus 22 degrees up there. So we're kind of getting ourselves ready to leave the tea house situations behind and start living in tents and dealing with severe cold. But we've got the gear, and this is what we've come here to do, so I guess the sooner we get into that environment, the better. But I guess this is Paul signing out at Namche Bazaar, 3,400 metres, on the 3rd of April, 2014.
The trek to Everest Base Camp allows you time to get to know your teammates and to slowly get used to life at the high altitudes. The higher up you go, the thinner the air gets, and even walking uphill begins to feel like a struggle.
But as soon as you start moving and the oxygen demand gets created, you find that there's less available and you find it's more difficult. And you get out of breath, and you'll become completely out of breath within 10 steps. And you're hoping you won't meet anyone on the route, because if you had to have a conversation with anyone, it was a conversation where both people are completely out of breath. And you have this kind of feeling that you haven't a measure yet of how good you are versus everyone else. So you don't want to meet somebody that then is talking to you while you're out of breath and they're fine and they're staring at you going, you want to climb Everest. So that's constantly playing in the back of your mind a little bit. But yeah, any movement at all and you really feel the demand.
In these early days of the Track 2 Everest Base Camp, finding it difficult to breathe while hiking at over 3,400 metres isn't the only challenge Paul faces.
So it's now about 2 o'clock on the 7th of April. I'm in Dingbaché today, and this is our second day in Dingbaché. So we arrived in here the day before yesterday, and we're going to spend 2 days here basically acclimatising. So yesterday was the climb up out of here to a mountain about 5,000 metres high, 5,045 metres high. It was good, nice day, really good to be up on a peak, our first peak so far. Got some nice photos, but on the way down, I could feel some of the cold that I had the week before I came to Nepal starting to creep back in and starting to feel nasally and starting to feel congestion and throat and all the rest of it. By the time I got back down here, it was evident that cold had sort of re-emerged and blossomed again. So yeah, I've been feeling pretty crap, pretty miserable for the last 24 hours. And yeah, I'm just trying to get rid of this damn thing. So I'm gonna see how I go, and if I have to carve out a kind of a separate itinerary from here to base camp, then so be it. I don't mind that. It takes me away from the group, but at the end of the day, it's about getting healthy and being able to do this thing when we get up there.
It's very difficult when you're at altitude to defend yourself against even something as simple as a common cold. Your immune system is slightly compromised already because of the physiological stress that your body is under generally. So that means both fighting and shifting a cold quickly as we normally might with the normal treatment that we might use may become ineffective. And really, the only way you're going to shift something like that is to drop down a little bit in altitude and then treat appropriately.
Today is the 9th of April. I think it's the 9th of April. And yeah, it is. And I'm heading in the wrong direction. For the first time, I'm heading back down the... Just drinking some soup here. I'm heading back down the mountain. Grab some salt. If I left the team behind, they're heading up to Gorik Shep. We just all spent the night at Le Boucher, about 4,800 metres. And my cold in my head, which you can hear, is becoming a cold in my chest, which is a bigger problem. So I need to get rid of it. And I can't get rid of it at altitude and up high. So I've got to head down as far as I can until I get enough oxygen in my system that my immune system starts to bulk up and beat off this virus. Because up higher it'll develop into something nasty like pneumonia, or even worse. So it's a bit disheartening, gotta be honest. It's not nice turning right when your team turns left, you know? Feels a bit shit. It kind of feels like you failed a little bit, but it's good for the head to do it. It teaches your brain to understand that you're making decisions now for the next two months that affect your health, your well-being, your success rate on the mountain, the odds of you getting to the top, and frankly on summit day, your life as well. So I better sack up and learn how to make those decisions early, hadn't I? The goal is the summit. That's it.
Taking part in the Seven Summits Challenge is hard on the body. You have to deal with extreme cold, physical injuries, and both mental and physical exhaustion.
So there was times where he came back home and he was noticeably gaunt. So you could definitely see it had its effects on it. But I suppose he'd say that's part and parcel of it, you know, the end result's going to be completely worth it.
Mountains are unpredictable places, which is why Paul puts so much effort into planning every single step of the way. But as he learned back in 2008, while climbing in South America, there are just some things, both on and off the mountain, that are beyond his control.
It's about 5,000 metres. We were acclimatising, both Niall and myself. It was a hard, hard day. And we'd come down off the mountain after a long day, heading into the track that brings you right into our base camp, and someone called out my name. And he said, such and such a person has called, you need to call home. And that's all I knew for about 2.5 hours. And then eventually, over dinner, they took me out of the tent during the dinner, brought me over to the mess tent, and he just stood in front of me and he said, your father, he had a heart attack, and he kind of put his hand up to his heart. He had a heart attack. He is dead. and that was it. And then the mission was, right, okay, I'm on the in the middle of the Andes on the Argentinian-Chilean border, and I've got to get to Longford. So when I came back, you're kind of confronted with a surreal situation. You're kind of wondering why you're not still on the mountain. What's going on here? I'm meant to be halfway up a mountain at the moment. This is madness. And it takes you quite a long time to realise what's actually happened in front of you, or what is happening in front of you.
3 years later, Paul made it back to that mountain in South America, and he brought with him a pebble from his father's grave to lay on the summit. It was the fifth mountain of the Seven Summits Challenge.
It's April 13th, Sunday, and just getting ready to to leave Namcheong.
A few days later, back on Everest, and Paul is recovering from his cold. He's had to turn around and hike back down the mountain to lower altitudes, just to give his body a chance to recover. But now he's back on track.
So it's been 3 days of rest here at Namcheong, which I've really appreciated. It was time to get cracking, get back up and, you know, prove that this cold is behind me. There's a few sniffles and a little bit of it still around, but I think enough of it is gone that we can get on with this. So looking forward to getting back into the groove of it. It's Easter week and it's an important week because there's a lot of big things potentially going to happen and actually going to happen. My brother and his wife are expecting their first kid. So that's due this week, actually due on the 14th. Of April, which is tomorrow, which is my dad's, it would have been my dad's 70th birthday. So that's a big milestone as well in the week. So I'm really looking forward to good news. I'm really looking forward to hearing about a new niece or nephew this week. And I gather likely to be late rather than early. So, you know, maybe I'll be in base camp when she arrives. You never know. And it's going to take, I guess, the rest of this week to get acclimatized to the high mountain or to the base camp level, including climbing 6,100 meter peak, Lebeche East. So that's all ahead. And with a bit of luck, by next Saturday, I should be rolling into base camp. So from Namche, heading up the mountain, this is Paul signing out.
Paul rejoins his team a few days later, and on April 17th, he reaches the peak of Lebeche. For the first time, he can actually see Everest Base Camp in front of him.
We're on top of Lebeche East at 6,100 metres, so just getting something to eat. It's been a long day. We've been on the go since 4:30. It's now 9:15. And it's quite the summit. Lebeche, the main summit, is towering over us here on the left. But yeah, we're on Lebeche East and looking right down into base camp, into the Kumba Valley, and straight across to Everest. It's a perfect weather day. Blue skies, nice sunshine, but that was hard going. Hopefully a snack now and head back down and regain some strength and get ready for the ice fall. I'm looking across at it here and it's menacing, so it's there's a lot of work to do. So on top of Lebeche East, 18th of April, 2014, at 6,119 meters.
Up ahead is base camp, and one of the most dangerous parts of climbing Everest, the Khumbu Icefall. It's around a mile and a half stretch of huge chunks of ice the size of cars and buses, stretched over deep crevasses, and the whole thing is constantly moving, twisting, and shaking.
Base camp is an awe-inspiring place. You get there, you're elated to get there. You settle into your tent, and immediately in the first night, you can hear the glacier moving, cracking underneath you. In that way, it's almost intimidating. You're looking directly at the Khumbu Icefall, and there's like a sixth sense within your body which tells you that's not a great place to be. You know, it's exactly what it says on the tin. It's a moving glacier coming down off the highest mountain in the world. You can tell that there's danger.
As Paul and the team of climbers take pictures from the summit, the mood on top of Lebeche is a triumphant one. But at this stage, nobody has any idea that 2 hours earlier, Everest and the Khumbu Icefall have been struck by one of the worst ever climbing disasters.
12 Nepalese mountain guides have died in an avalanche on Mount Everest this morning. Officials say the avalanche happened at around 6:30 local time.
When I read this, immediately I went, oh no. And I sent a message immediately around to everyone in the family saying, there was an avalanche and this is pretty serious. There's a number of people dead here. This is big news.
Everest's deadliest day. The avalanche hit on the mountain's most popular route, leaving at least 12 dead and 5 missing. The dead were all Nepalese guides. They were caught relatively low on the mountain.
So it's Good Friday, the 18th of April, and we're back in Lebashe. I'm just walking through the little village here. And it's been quite a day. Because it's been a bit of a disastrous day at base camp. We came back to a report that almost 20 Sherpas had been killed in the icefall today. And it looks as if that's for the most part true. So you can see the fallout of it everywhere. Every Sherpa in our team is touched by it, either through a relative or a friend. And it's a very hard day for them. It's the single greatest disaster in the history of Everest. We don't know what's going to happen now the next few days, frankly. So we're just eagerly watching that, and let's see how things pan out. So we're due in base camp tomorrow. It'll be my first trip to base camp on this expedition, so I'm looking forward to that. But it's tinged with the sadness of today, and yeah, it's going to be a tough place to be for the next few days. But it's much tougher for the families of the Sherpas, so that's what we think about tonight. From Lebashe on a crisp, cold evening on Good Friday.
Back home in Ireland, before leaving for Everest, Paul had spent hours poring over maps and diagrams, explaining to Colm and his family where he would be on any given day.
We knew where he was, and that was before he would have contacted us. We knew he wasn't going to be there, so we were pretty comfortable that he was okay. But he did ring my mum as well, just to, you know, because he did realise he did have to ring home and just make sure, so she heard his voice. But as well as that, I think he just realised just having a conversation with her, at least a short one, whatever, was what they both needed, possibly.
But interesting, your mum, she thought that you should still stick with it and,
yeah,
and still try and make the climb.
I mean, obviously, we're from our point of view over here, we don't get a sense of what, we're only getting partial bits of information about what's happening. So the opportunity for him to climb was there. And when you've been climbing peaks for 7 years and you've reached the end goal and there it is in sight, why on earth would you give up?
It's the 19th of April and I've finally arrived into base camp. It's 24 hours now since the big disaster up on the icefall, and the numbers we're getting so far are that there's 16 confirmed dead, and we don't know how big that's going to get, but you can kind of see from where we are where the avalanche has happened, but you can't make out anything else. There's no signs of anything else. We've seen choppers coming in and out all day on our way up here and from Lebashe this morning. But it's, I guess it looks and feels no different than it would the day before, but we're all sitting in wait now wondering what's going to happen. Priority is obviously to get those folks down off the mountain and back to their families, and that's going to be a lengthy process. And once that's done, to work out, you know, how to make safe the icefall, and even whether it can be made safe, you know, whether what's happened has compromised the icefall or not, I don't know. We're going to find that out in the next few days. It's Easter Sunday, the 20th of April, and I'm stood here at the bottom of the icefall, looking right up. It doesn't look like anything is untoward when you're looking up at the icefall from where I am. It just looks like another day, you know. There's Everest, there's clouds above it. Very, very unusual clouds with spectrum of light flying off them. It's very dramatic looking. That's the jet stream up there. Everest is calm and peaceful. The summit doesn't look all that far away. I can see it from here. I think I can anyway.
The summit seems close, but as the situation unfolds at base camp, the possibility of reaching the top is slipping further away.
Today, all the Sherpas and some big team guys are going to meet and decide whether we put a stop to the whole season or not. So it's a big day in terms of deciding what happens this year or doesn't happen. You can see the Sherpas are shaking. You can see it physically in their faces, actually. And they're, you know, they're wondering whether the mountain's angry and, you know, the gods of Sagamartha are saying this is not a year to climb, and that's their spirituality and their belief, and that's going to actually decide what they do and what they don't do. So they're going to decide whether they want to go on, and we can't go on without Sherpas. So let's see how it goes. But yeah, interesting times on Everest, an interesting Easter Sunday.
In the days that followed, time slowed down at Everest as climbers and Sherpas tried to come to terms with what had just happened, mourning the loss of their brothers and meeting up to discuss what was going to happen next.
And when there is a tragedy like this, does everything stop for a time or does business continue as usual?
Well, I suppose again, it'll certainly stop.
It was very confusing. There were a lot of breaking news over the days, which would then be contradicted by the afternoon. And that was happening a lot. And at a certain point, from our own perspective in working on social media, it came to a point where the only word that we were going to take was Paul's word.
I would say, you know, within certainly a fairly short period of time, again, the Sherpas will be back and they'll be fixing ropes and the expeditions will be moving again. It's the nature of, I suppose, the large...
So the big Sherpa meeting's going on across the way from us here. You can hear some of the noise. All of the Sherpa leaders have come together to think and talk about what's happened and what's going to happen over the next few weeks. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting outcome. We're just waiting to hear back, but yeah, there's been a lot of roaring and shouting and cheering, and one guy in the centre seems to be leading the pack, and they're talking about what risk they may have and what's happened to up to 20 of their colleagues in the past few days. So it's a very emotion driven meeting, I'm sure, but our leader Mingma's over there with the rest of the team, so we should hear back soon. There's a helicopter circling overhead, taking some photographs and examining the icefall behind us to see if it's safe, but also taking some snaps here of what's going on. It's a pretty historic thing, really, I suppose. Sherpas deciding how they're going to progress on their mountain, I suppose, which it is. And they'll ultimately decide if they want to go on or not. So we're waiting to hear back on that.
But the Sherpas, am I right in saying, have decided collectively that they feel climbing should cease for this year?
I don't think all the Sherpas have, but a big majority of the Sherpas have actually decided that they are not going to go back up on the mountain. And I think that is their prerogative in relation to the fact that...
Every year, the Nepalese government takes in around $4 million to licenses for climbing the mountain. Climbers would be lost without Sherpas, and Sherpas and their families rely on the income from the climbing industry to survive. After the accident, however, it was revealed that just $400 was offered to Sherpa families to help with funeral costs.
We wish this is just a bad dream. We want to wake up with a fresh dream. We wish we
are just... As the meetings progressed, sorrow and that sense of loss quickly turned to anger and frustration, and a standoff quickly developed between the Sherpas demanding better working conditions and the government, with climbers like Paul caught in between.
Those my brothers on the mountain, and I hope they will find a quick path to the Nirvana.
I'm strongly we only heard of a pocket of the demands, which all seemed logical. All of them, you know. More helicopter support at base camp, more money for the families seemed logical, better insurance seemed logical. Anything that makes the situation at base camp safer, that makes the livelihood of the Sherpas more secure, it's got to be a good thing. You know, these guys, like us, they're putting themselves in harm's way, but they're doing it more often than we are. They're going through the icefall more often than we go through it, by a factor sometimes of 10. So, you know, how could you argue with these things? And I think everyone we spoke to and the feeling within our group was good for them. Good for them.
We would like to put a pressure on the government. Government must support the deceased family. They must help for the kids to get the complete education. I don't want to see them to sleep in the road. I don't want to see them to be in the street. And for this, to put the pressure to the government, I hope that all the Western friends, brothers and sisters from all over the world, and all the Nepalese Sherpas, my friend, my brothers, let's put a hand together and let's request the government to support these people. Thank you very much, guys.
As talks continue, the future of the climbing season on Everest remains uncertain. A few days later, a traditional puja ceremony takes place to pay respects to the dead.
We didn't know that we were attending the finality of this. We didn't know that we were standing around in the last days of Everest 2014 on the Nepal side. We had no sense of that at all.
It's Wednesday the 23rd of April at base camp again. Yeah, it's been a day of mixed emotion today. Up this morning, usual time, breakfast at 8. We knew there was a meeting planned for this morning to negotiate with the ministry down in Kathmandu. And we had dinner there just about an hour ago, and Mi'kmaq came in and told us that many of the teams are now pulling off the mountain and going home. So I don't know what's next. And yeah, let's see what happens tomorrow.
The next day, the remaining expedition leaders make the unprecedented decision to leave the mountain and abandon the season.
Ultimately, we've all come away with nothing, but we've come away with our lives, I guess, which is more than the 16 Sherpas. And again, it's hard to find any comfort in that. That's a dreadful thing to say, but it's really hard in the moment of the collapse of your aspiration to find some sort of you know, comfort in the fact that you're still around, because you always expected you would be. You just expected you would be and have the mountain climbed as well.
Everest 2014 is over. It's been a crushing disappointment for Paul and his team. But there was some good news waiting for him when he arrived home. A new niece.
The baby was late. And very late. I didn't want to come out at all. So I was back in Kathmandu when that child was born. Little Olivia. A little Olivia, so a little niece.
You've been back in Ireland, Paul. You know, it's been a couple of months now since Everest. How do you view the whole experience now?
Some of the anger belonged in the situation. I mean, you don't have that now. You know, you gutted that you didn't get the opportunity, and you got to face into all of the training again. And, you know, you start to see the pictures from Kathmandu of the funerals and the families. And, you know, we've started a fund, Sherpa fund, to try and raise money for the avalanche appeal, and you know, you get involved in things like that. But I still bemoan the fact that there was a lack of coordinated leadership across all of the Westerners and the Sherpa to come together and say, no, this is how we're going to run it. And that after a period of acceptable mourning, that the season should have resumed, as it will resume next year, and there will be 500 people in base camp next year, and life will go on.
Will you be one of them?
I hope to be one of them. I don't know.
2014 was the darkest year on Mount Everest. The debate over Sherpa working conditions continues, but Paul and his team are still determined to get him to the top of that very famous mountain.
He will end up achieving his goal, and certainly we're going to help him get to that final step, get to that final summit.
We have to move forward. And that was the thing, it's like the same way in the mountain, you have to keep moving forward. If you stay still, it's going to consume you and take you over. and we're not going to let that happen.
I don't think that he'll be happy until he's standing on the top of Everest with the flag saying, I did it.
At the end of the day, what you want to do is stand on the top and come back home. And you have to find the way to do it. And, you know, we found a way to get there once. We'll find a way to get back.